campus region, as my wife and I are serving. We're just really excited about what's happening here. This is a great idea. This is a really great idea.
Wow.
Someone laughing? I thought the speaker was coming for a second. It's almost as great of an idea as having Garnett do security. I mean, that's top tier big brain idea right there. I'm also just, kind of echoing what Rob said, I'm just so grateful for the friendship we have with the Novaks and the teamwork and how our kids are becoming friends. Lucas loves your home. So he'll come and make a mess and then leave. And we're just grateful that you guys let us do that. So we're so grateful for your friendship. And also, it's also a very special day today because my fellow Jasper, Gigi, is here. We go to the same school. I'm currently back in school with Gigi. So, Jaspers. I don't know what a Jasper is. I think it's a guy, right?
It's a guy.
It's an actual person is our mascot. But I'm really excited today to be continuing your series here in the book of Mark, specifically today looking at Mark 2, verse 13. The story about a guy who has, his name is Levi. And my wife and I, our youngest son, his name is Levi as well. So this passage actually had a lot to do with why I kind of threw Levi in the mix for names. So just the fact that it lined up like this is really cool. Let's get into it. Mark 2, we're going to read from verse 13 to 17 as our main text for the day. All right, cool. So Mark 2, 13 says, once again, Jesus went out beside the lake. A large crowd came to him, and he began to teach them. As he walked along, he saw Levi, son of Alphaeus, sitting in the tax collector's booth. Follow me, Jesus told him, and Levi got up and followed him. While Jesus was having dinner at Levi's house, many tax collectors and sinners were eating with him and his disciples, for there were many who followed him. When the teachers of the law, who were Pharisees, saw him eating with sinners and tax collectors, they asked his disciples, why does he eat with tax collectors and sinners? On hearing this, Jesus said, it is not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners. So here's the passage, and there's a lot going on here that's not necessarily mentioned. So the Jews at the time were living under Roman authority, honestly Roman oppression, and they had these like sketchy ways of collecting taxes from, the Romans were collecting taxes from the Jews. They would do this by like hiring other Jews to like set up in different city points and collect, honestly, like these wild sketchy fees. Like there's like a fishing boat fee, a fee for the amount of fish that you catch, a selling fish fee, like just in a, like those existence fees. It was like if you think it's sketchy here and now, the setup in this situation was bonkers. And they also weren't like, I say, you know, hired in quotations because the tax collectors weren't actually paid. They weren't given a salary or whatever. They just put it on themselves to charge everyone a little bit extra on the taxes, and they would pocket whatever was remaining, which sure, maybe at the beginning was a smooth idea, but then you give someone that kind of power and you're backed by the Roman government, you can start asking for a lot of stuff, a lot of money, a lot of things, and that's kind of, that became the culture of the tax collectors, that they were these kind of sketchy guys hired by the enemy to collect extra money to pay the enemy and pad their pockets. So it was a rough situation. They were seen as traitors by their own people as working for the Roman government, but also thieves because they're taking extra money for themselves. Levi, the name, actually means attached or connected in the Hebrew language. So I'm sure there was like this inside joke among people that knew him that he was attached to the enemy or connected to the oppressor and honestly joined to a life of solitude because no one was trying to marry a tax collector because of what that communicated to the rest of the family. So he was most likely completely isolated from everyone else, joined to the enemy, attached to the oppressor. It was just a mess. He was probably seen as attached to his faith, attached to being lonely. He was a lot of things. He was also the apostle Matthew. Take a look with me in Matthew 9. Matthew 9, verse 9. So Levi is a bunch of things, right? And then in Matthew 9, 9, it says, as Jesus went on from there, he saw a man named Matthew sitting at the tax collector's booth. Follow me, he told him, and Matthew got up and followed him. While Jesus was having dinner at Matthew's house, many tax collectors and sinners came and ate with him and his disciples. When the Pharisees saw this, they asked the disciples, why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners? On hearing this, Jesus said, it is not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. So it's the same story. It's the same message, the same narrative of the life of Levi as told here through Matthew, I think very strategically on Matthew's part. But the point is that, like, name changes happen a lot throughout the Bible, and they're always significant. If you pay attention to people's names changing, they're always significant. Abram means high father, H-I-G-H, as in, like, level, not any other version of high. Dad jokes, come on, dude. I'm 30. So Abram means high father, and he gets his name changed to Abraham, which means father of multitudes, because that's what happened. He was once just this father, and then God changed his name to Abraham because he was going to become the father of multitudes. Jacob, which is, Jacob means pretty much like, I took power sketchily. Like, the way that I came to be in a place of authority, it was kind of like a little bit shady. That's what Jacob means. If you have friends named Jacob, like, tell them that. He gets his name changed to Israel, meaning contention with God, or honestly, like, power with God. So he goes from taking power sketchily to having power with God. And if you know his story, that's exactly what happened. Yeah. He takes power and like the older sonship in a sketchy way, goes through all sorts of transformations, and then he has power with God. Simon means God has heard, and Petros, or Peter, means rock. So Simon gets his name changed to Peter, and the rock is, yes, the testimony of who the identity of Jesus is, but also, like, Peter becomes a huge foundational block in the start of Christianity. Like he becomes one of the main guys, and the voice that you hear in Acts 2 with the repenting and baptized, that's him. So he goes from being just this God has heard to now being this rock, this foundation. But notice the timing of the name changes here. It's, you will be the father of multitudes, so I'm going to change your name. You will have power with God, so I'm going to change your name. These names weren't put on the tombstone for the first time. It was a name change, but then the implied, you have to change your life to match this as well. So Levi goes from being attached to Matthew, meaning gift of Yahweh, gift of God. So he goes from the process of being attached to all of these negative things to now his life is a gift of God, and he's going to share this gift with other people as well. Right there, the gift doesn't come down the line after he figures it out. Jesus calls him in that moment to be to accept the gift of Yahweh and live the gift of Yahweh as well. So today, you might be sitting here feeling attached to something that's potentially holding you back and keeping you stuck in your own, like, maybe personal tax collector's booth. Whether you're maybe attached or connected to impurity, attached or connected to lack of motivation, or kind of joined to meh, you know, the meh stuff that can kind of keep you kind of stuck. Like you might feel attached to all of that. And let me make this very clear, that God is in the business of transformation. You can't, though, just sit back and wait for these changes to happen. Yeah. God doesn't transform us and then we sit and kind of wait for, God gives you the inspiration and the direction and the motivation, and then you have to live these changes in yourself. Jesus tells Levi to follow him. That implies change already. You have to change your career. You have to change your priorities. You have to change your identity. Whatever insecurity you felt about your job and how people are looking at you, you have to drop that right now, because Jesus is asking you to follow him. And Jesus had plans for Matthew to literally change the world. We're not given a lot of information about his life, but you're reading the book of Matthew right now. I referred to text that details the sovereignty of Christ and the life of Jesus in an account that we got from Matthew's firsthand perspective. So Jesus had plans to change the world through this man. He just had to leave what he was attached to in his life of Levi and change now to Matthew. You might even be looking at this campus region as it's in a very kind of like ground level foundational phases and feel like we're attached to this. We're attached to this size room. But what if God has plans for a stadium somewhere? Okay. What if God has plans for multiple services because you can't fit in one spot? There's so many students in this area that if you feel attached to where things are at right now, you might miss the transformation that God has planned for you guys as well. But you have to live this change out. Like, again, it's not going to be because, like, there's a lesson and then magic happens. It's not going to be like you wake up and all of a sudden you're motivated. You have to decide to be these changes, to leave the attachments, whatever's holding you back, and live the gift of God that he's given you in your salvation and share that with others as well. And let me tell you, like, living a transformed life, like, they might not put it in the brochure, but it's very challenging. John 12. In John 12, right after Lazarus gets raised from the dead, it's like one verse, but you know they tried to kill him again? Wow. Like, if you just read the narrative of Lazarus, Jesus heals him from the, like, brings him back to life, and they're like, yo, we gotta kill this guy. Because if he's out there walking, it's gonna validate Jesus. So Jesus literally transforms Lazarus's life from death to now being alive, and the Pharisees are like, nah, he's gotta go. So if you're trying to live transformed life, best believe the world is gonna attack that. They tried to kill Lazarus after, I mean, give the guy a break. He was dead. He was dead. But I think sometimes we get surprised by challenge and persecution, and it kind of makes us feel, I'm out. Well, it might be part of the plan, right? Part of the process to push through these challenges and live this transformed life. And let me also, I mean, we're gonna get to the Jesus transformation part a little bit here, but if your race or your gender or your upbringing or your family situation or your whatever it is has ever made you feel like somehow you are less capable of transformation, like, knock that out. Like, that's just not how it works. That there's nothing you bring to the table based on your life that makes God less able to transform you and those around you. Right. Like you don't bring any shortcomings so heavy that now you're stuck there forever. Right. Like, Levi was in a rough situation. Like, I would go as far as to say probably rougher than any of us have it, because we have a supportive community around us. Yeah. Levi had nothing, and God used his life. So whatever it is, whatever thing you might feel based on what you've been told directly or indirectly or perceived or whatever it is, God can transform even that. Yeah. To something that makes himself incredibly, incredibly clear. Let's take a look here in verse 15 of the same passage, Mark 2. Mark 2 in verse 15. So you have this, this is now Jesus in Levi's house. And you have this this beautiful moment of God himself handpicking someone ostracized by the community to be part of his plan to bring heaven home. And that man goes on to invite guests who are also the outsiders and forgottens, and they're eating with the Son of God. You can just kind of read this and move past, but like visually, this is incredible, because you have like the juxtaposition of how the whole world works. Jesus comes into the home of the broken to befriend the lost. Mm-hmm. And then in the middle of this beautiful, poetic, like, wow, you have the Son of Man in here just like kicking it with a bunch of like losers, then the haters show up. Because one thing about haters is like they're gonna show up. they're probably already there, just quiet, waiting for their chance to put the mask down and say something crazy. Like haters are there, and right here you have the specific version of haters, the New England Pharisees. It's so hard to distinguish sometimes between the Patriots and the Pharisees. And like the words are so similar, it like throws me off. Not the New England Patriots, sorry. It was the Pharisees. Sorry about that. The Pharisees, show up with all of their hate, and I need to speak to a manager. Like what's what are these people doing here? Like they come in ready to like get someone in trouble. Why does he eat with sinners? If he's this holy, holy savior guy that John the Baptist character was talking about, yapping about how he's God and he's special, if he's that guy, he would never associate himself with these people. Why does he eat with sinners? We, the Pharisees, only eat with good, pure, clean people who have it all together, and we're top tier righteous. So if he's claiming to be somebody, why does he eat with sinners? This is actually a much more powerful statement of fact than it is a question of motive, right? If you eliminate the question, if you eliminate why, just look at what's being stated here. Jesus eats with sinners. Jesus, fully God, fully divine, creator of all things, pure and blameless, and literally saturating with earthquaking power inside him, eats, ingests food for sustenance. In group settings, this communicates a willing interaction and friendship with the company that you're in. So he befriends these people with his guards down, sinners, those who have disobeyed God's perfect plan for our thoughts, our words, and actions. Jesus eats with sinners. We have given Jesus billions upon billions of reasons to not want to eat with us. Yep. Adam and Eve were given a simple task. Like, yo, like, just hold it down, guys. Just hold it down, and I'll be right back. And they're like, nah, we got a better plan. And we have been suffering ever since. Cain kills Abel. Like, again, it's just, bro, just take what you've been given and show that you're grateful. And Cain's like, yeah, no, I'm just going to go ahead and kill this guy because his standard is higher than mine. God rescues the Israelites from slavery, and they immediately write like a bad Yelp review of the experience. And like, nah, we gotta go back. It was better over there. The kings worship foreign kings. I'm sorry, the kings worship foreign gods. The people worship foreign kings. And then it all gets to this point where God is like, okay, well, here's Jesus, and then we killed him. So if you just like think about how we have treated this, and then Jesus chooses to eat with sinners. Jesus will eat with you. He will bring himself down. He'll put himself in a position where he requires food to sustain himself, which is bonkers, because he was there at the creation of like mankind, and now he's like, okay, I'm gonna downgrade so much that I need to eat, which is crazy. And he's gonna come down and befriend you, even though you've given him reason not to, even though you have played him directly, consistently, and will play him again. He chooses to befriend you and eat with you. So the question is no longer about why does he eat with sinners. The question is, will you sit with him? Yeah. Will you eat with him? Will you befriend Jesus? Will you defend Jesus? Will you stand up for his righteousness and standard, even if the world wants that conviction sat down? In my junior year, oh my gosh, dude, junior year of college, which is like super long ago at this point, I took a Bible class because I wanted an easy A. Nope, that's where I went wrong. So it was an 8 a.m. class. I know. It was a 3 hour long 8 a.m. class. And it was not a Saturday, but I worked overnight shifts the night before. But I'm like, hey, but it's the Bible. Like, I do this. Like, I'm gonna show up. I don't get require reading. I have like six of them. Like, I have all the Bibles. So I'm like, I'm thinking I'm good to go. First class, 8 o'clock in the morning. I'm ready to like dominate the discussion. And the professor is like, well, who here believes in God? Stinking me, yo, I'm that guy, I believe in God. And she was like, you idiots. I was like, what? And the entire semester, this woman, like, dude, she didn't even look at the syllabus. She just goes on these rants about how people that believe in God are like not quite mentally evolved like everyone else. And like just and it was nuts. It was crazy. Like, and I'm thinking, okay, cool. Well, you know, I just I'll do the work and I'll participate every now and then. But it was like every class, 3 hours long of just hearing her go on these non like syllabus, like it was a disaster. We actually got into quite heated arguments throughout the semester, which I, you know, there's some that I regret, some I feel really good about. actually, our final paper was to, I wish I had the prompt to show you guys. It was pretty much like, because of the inconsistencies throughout the Synoptic Gospel, write a, I don't know, 8 or 9 page paper about why the New Testament cannot be trusted as a reliable historical source.
Oh, Lord.
That's the paper. So I talked to my dad and he was like, well, just like write 2 papers. Take like one paper of what she wants you to say and one paper marked very clearly, here's what I believe. And I was like, yeah, I'm gonna write 2 papers now. That's crazy. So I wrote my paper of like, you know, I completely disagree, here's why. It was honestly like, impeccable paper, and I got like an A- for the class. It was an A plus paper. I didn't, you know, but you know, she's a hater, so it is what it is. But there was one particular moment in this class when this professor built up for an hour and a half this, like, you know, whatever history, whatever evidence, whatever, to pretty much get to the landing point of the crucifixion never happened. It just never happened, and here's the evidence why it didn't happen. And she was of Jewish descent, so I put my hand up, and I kid you not, I said, Miss, the Holocaust never happened.
Oh.
And that was the reaction. And now I'm like, bro, I did, I said it. Oh, no. And I said, well, Miss, because I have found sources that communicate that it was actually doctored images and fake stats and numbers that were kind of propaganda against the losing side of the war, and that's what I believe. And it was like, I'm waiting for the president of Queens College to come in and escort me immediately to prison. But then what I tell her is, like, okay, so I obviously don't believe that. I obviously like 100% believe that the Holocaust was actually the evidence of people that are living outside God's plan, and it shows you how bad humans can get if we disobey what God gives us. But Professor, it's crazy that you can make that kind of statement when people that I know are living every single day of their lives based on the reality and the historical fact that Jesus lived, died, and was resurrected. So if you're gonna make these crazy statements, like, me too. And she took a sabbatical the next school year. So I don't know if it was me. But honestly, like my thought was, you're not gonna sit here and talk about Jesus like that. Like, there's no way. Like listen, I'm not big enough to physically or spiritually defend the Son of God. So he doesn't need me to back him up. But goodness gracious, lady, like, you're not going to sit here and talk crazy about the Savior of the world. I'm just like, or without someone else saying something like to support Jesus. And that was the conviction that I came in there with. Now, years removed, there's probably a better way to do that. But the reality is that we have eyewitness testimony of the risen Christ. There's historical evidence that corroborates the life and teachings of Jesus, so much evidence that it makes other proclaimed existing historical figures seem like, I don't know if we believe that they exist, because there's so much, there's thousands of manuscripts that are so deep, like, are in such great detail that during the time they were written and presented, people could go fact check that day. Like the apostles communicate this area, this tomb, this city, this like person's in charge. If you get a copy of this, just go check for yourself. And we have these copies that are strictly passed on and passed on. Now we have it. There's people. We have manuscripts supporting the life of Jesus from people that supported Christianity, from enemies of Christianity, and people watching Christianity like, yo, what is that? Like, we have these, like, there's so much evidence that logically, it doesn't make sense to not stand up for Jesus.
Yeah.
It doesn't, because all the just as much as we have the evidence supporting that today is Sunday, like, Jesus was a real life person who taught this, and it's not based on a book. She kept saying, like, you're really gonna base your life based on a book? Absolutely not, bro. I would be crazy to tell you that you should believe in God because the Bible as one document says so.
Right.
That is crazy. This is not one document. There's thousands of manuscripts that support this. It's not one author. It's people that saw and like, wow, you saw that too, right? Let's jot this down. Like, it's thousands of individually like supportive documents and manuscripts. And it'll be very different if there's one author. If one guy, I don't know, but I don't trust one guy. But I can trust a couple hundred. I can trust a couple thousand, especially people that died for it. If, like, because you're not going to put your life on the risk, like, life at risk, if you know that you're pretending.
Yeah.
Like, it's not gonna happen. At the point of we're gonna kill you, bro, I'm just kidding, y'all. But like, you're not going to get tortured and watch someone in front of you get tortured and say yes to it as well, unless you know that it's true.
Yeah.
So there's hundreds of these eyewitness testimonies that support that it's true. So when people make these statements like, nah, this is not real, the crucifixion didn't happen. I'm like, bro, read a book. Like, educate yourself. Because it clearly, even at risk of a B in that class, even at risk of failing that class, I came in like, there's no way I'm gonna let you talk about Jesus like that. So he has made it very clear that he will eat with me, that he will sit and befriend me. So now I have to, now, let me also say that it's in my character to say that kind of thing in a public setting. Like, I've said wild stuff because I was like in public whatevers. It's a lot more challenging for me to do that in silence and by myself and when no one is looking. And like defending Jesus when you're the only one in the room, and what defending Jesus when you know he's in your head, and like seeing what you're seeing, like fault, like just kind of checking where your eyes go and where you allow your heart to go. Like, I can do the dramatic one time big, like, wow, that was crazy, but it's harder to like not get upset at someone driving. Like, and not let my heart go to a place of now am I defending Jesus with my thoughts and my feelings in this situation?
Yeah.
So as much as sometimes the big stuff kind of gets the attention, that's a lot less common than how much Jesus wants us to defend him and befriend him in these kind of day-to-day interactions.
Yeah.
And like what you're swiping and what you're liking and what you're allowing yourself to take in. Like, would you do that to a friend that was living in your head? Like the stuff that you're allowing like into your thoughts. So put that there as well. I also think that cancel culture has created coward Christians.
Yeah. Wow.
We're so afraid, we're so stinking afraid to like go against the trendy that we'll just like accept sin.
Yeah.
We'll just straight up accept sin because we're worried about what putting our foot down communicates to the rest of the world. And the truth is, it communicates that we're friends with Jesus. And I'm not saying, like, go out and be bigots. I'm not saying go out and be holier than thou. This scripture gives you no clearance to do that.
Yeah.
Verse 17, it's not the healthy that need a doctor, but the sick. And that's us.
Yeah.
That's all of us. We're never the doctor in this situation. We're never the hospital in this situation. We're never the surgeon in this situation. We are constantly the sick that have the amazing blessing of having God take care of us and then allows us to bring other people to him as well. You can't read this passage and arrogantly say you're more spiritual than somebody else. You can't do that. But at the same time, we also can't pretend like the world isn't trying to make sin okay, like all the time. And they've rebranded as tolerance and acceptance and love. And those are all God words that they've stolen and hijacked to mean something that justifies a lack of righteousness. And we can't do that and befriend Jesus at the same time.
Yeah.
I'm the guy that won't go to a doctor. I have have like a high level of belief in ginger ale and Vicks. And tea and hot tea. That's me. When I was younger, like in, around high school, I had ulcers, like stomach ulcers. And like my stomach hurt, but I'm like, bro, it's a stomach ache. Like, man up, you know? And I, like for weeks, I was like, it hurts, but it's not that bad. Dude, I burped and had like blood in my mouth one day. And I was like, no, it's really bad. Like that's not normal bodily functions. And we went to the hospital and they're like, bro, like your stomach is tore up. And if you would have said something 3-4 weeks ago, you might not be in the situation where you're gonna have to be in pain for a very long time. I was in the hospital for like maybe 10, 12 days of like, please more morphine type pain as like a 13-year-old. Because I allowed this to go on for so long to the point that like healing became way harder than it needed to be. Yeah. We can't pretend like we don't need doctors. We can't pretend like we don't need healing. We can't pretend like we don't constantly still to this day need repentance. We can't pretend like we don't need direction and righteousness. We can't pretend that we do not need Jesus.
Yeah.
Like that's not something that's like high level advanced Christianity. At its base level, if you don't function in a way that communicates that you desperately need Jesus, you're missing the point.
Yeah.
You're missing the entire thing. Like we literally on a practical day-to-day level cannot do this without Jesus. So rather than defending ourselves, rather than defending the world's sin, rather than going on the defensive of, no, everything is fine, just let Jesus heal you.
Mm-hmm.
Like, listen, in a room this size, there's a couple of people right here, right now, regardless of how happy you were singing and how many fist bumps and side hugs and everything is fine as you gave, there probably needs to be a lot of healing in this room.
Yeah.
Like something happened. Something is happening. You're worried about something going to happen that requires healing. If you try and pretend, listen, if you can get the help down the line, it's gonna be so much more painful. So much more like unnecessary stress on your body and your mind and your soul. Get the help today. Jesus came for that. Don't waste Jesus' time by telling him that you're good when you're not. Like he's done the work, and all we need to do is take the healing, because Jesus wants to transform you. Jesus looked at Levi and was like, dude, I have so much better plans for you than what you're attached to right now. And that doesn't end with Levi. That never ends. You have an equal ability to live a transformed life and transform those around you and be the gift of Yahweh that's there for you. Just let Jesus transform you. He also wants to befriend you. And yo, like, you know when you have the like followers list and every now and then someone is verified, it's like, yo, my friends are popular. Like Jesus, the Son of God, is like, I want to be your friend. I have two friends that follow me that like are just, you know, I mean, you know Kyle Norville, some of you guys might know. Kyle's wife is like low-key famous. And like she, you know, like likes my pictures. I'm like, wow. I did it. I made it. But like that's another person. Jesus Christ, the Son of God, the Creator of the universe, is like, I'm just trying to be close with you.
Right.
Like, and I'm willing to, like, we can't downgrade to make a relationship with Jesus work. We're dating way up, for that to happen. So he'll reach down and befriend us. We just have to do the same for him, because at the end of the day, no matter how like good you think you are, we all desperately need Jesus, right? But sure, the world needs Jesus, yes, we know that. But you sitting there today at a church service in the middle of Manhattan, like almost like 2 p.m., you need Jesus. And we have to act that way in order to fully understand the plan that God has for our lives. So he wants to transform you, he wants to befriend you, but you have to realize that you need him desperately. And the person you are living under that is exactly who God wants you to be. Thanks guys for letting me share. Thanks for your time.
Let's give it up one more time for Steven.